You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Welcome, everybody, to the 11th episode of The Psychologists Are In. I'm Maggie Lawson.
And I'm Timothy Amundsen.
And today we have an incredible episode for you guys. We are joined by executive producer Chris Henze. We love him so much. On this episode, we talk about season one, episode 10, From the Earth to Starbucks. And Chris shares some really fascinating stories, some stories from set, stories of his life, how he got involved with psych. It's so much fun. Anyway, enjoy, guys.
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Maggie.
How you doing, Tim?
I'm really good, Maggie. I'm excited to talk about From the Earth to Starbucks.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking when I was rewatching the episode last night, because it's the Psych Rewatch podcast.
And it's Psych Rewatch. And we are rewatching with all of you.
Yeah. Ish. Rewatcher podcast host now. And I was really struck by the fact that Starbucks is in the title, because Starbucks has been such a part of your and my friendship. And in our downtime, Max and I would often go at the Starbucks together and hang out.
That was our thing.
There's one particular spot in Vancouver, which is kind of right around the corner from where we always used to stay. It's on Rough Street, where there's two Starbucks that are kitty corner to each other. So we'd have to be very specific about if we're meeting a Starbucks
going which one way go, or the other. So there's
Starbucks and Thurlow.
And Robson Street, there's
Robson and Thurlow. Yeah.
So Robson and Thurlow, if you're going sort of heading, what would that be? North or south on Robson. Is it north south or is that east west? No, that is north south. There's one on either side of the street. So it picks up the foot traffic on either side. And Tim, do you know? Wait, was I watching this with you? No, I don't think so. Shrek? And I think it's Shrek 2, there's a joke. There's like this monster in the streets, and all of these people are hiding from the monster, and they are in a Starbucks. And the monster goes into the Starbucks, and they all start screaming and run across the street to the other Starbucks.
I don't remember
And I'm
that.
Like, oh, this is totally, has to be modeled after the Starbucks on Thurlow.
And there's a one of my favorite pictures of you and I, Mags, being out on the town hanging out, is the day where I kind of sniped by a paparazzi, and we were walking on Robson. We were coming back from
Starbucks,
that kitty corner Starbucks.
Mm-hmm. And having one of our, I'm sure, many deep Maggie Tim conversations that we still have daily.
And then one of our, also, my other favorite, still daily, we just don't, and then we'd back in L.A., because they're everywhere. It was always an easy place. Like, we'd go, hey, where do we want to meet? Let's meet at XYZ Starbucks.
Yeah.
Because you know it's going to be 10 minutes from our house, one of our houses.
Yeah.
And then one of our favorite things would be the morning text of, I'm stopping at Starbucks, what do you want?
Yep. Which we, after a while, got to the point where we knew exactly, you know, I think even with you, I'd be like, is it a black coffee or a red eye day? Like, there were some days that maybe you weren't going to go as hardcore. So we even knew our hangover hangover coffee days.
Why would we ever have hangovers, Maggie?
Oh, no. Just
never. Like last from this episode, I don't drink.
Oh, my God. How great.
For his list in this about, oh, wine, maybe at a wedding.
The occasional snifter
brandy. A good single malt scotch. I love that scene so much when he lists his, all the things he doesn't drink.
Yeah, maybe a little scotch. I was like, oh, this is when they started to pick up on all of our personal life and bringing it into our characters. There were so many. I mean, I this episode, I feel like, was kind of a turning point in season one. And I feel like we were so off and running. I mean, our friendship was kind of from day one anyway, but I really... everyone, you can see how comfortable we are getting with each other, I think, like comedy wise, joke wise, you know.
Me getting to have that scene with James really was like the first time we really had a nice sort of non-comedic scene together.
Yeah. Like, and a real, the fact that you're confiding in him, you know, when you're drunk, but still, there is a little mutual something, respect, trust, whatever going on there.
And then you see O'Hara wanting to really help her friend and partner Laster.
Yeah.
When she realizes she could get in huge trouble for helping Sean and Gus be the idiots that they are.
It's so good, though. I feel like Sean doing that for Lassiter makes Juliet see Sean in a different light, and we all, like, as the audience see him, there's a funny moment in the chief's office too. I know we talked about the fish, but, when we're having a conversation and I hold up my hand and he slaps it,
yeah,
which was a total Rodé improv. I'm pretty sure there's a, blooper somewhere. He just, every opportunity he could, he tried to crack us up and make us lose it, which usually worked.
First in this episode, I noticed another first.
What?
Which was not, it's when Sean and Gus were walking out of the space center and Dulé reveals he got some digits. And Sean, it was the very first, nice.
Nice, it's nice, which became that's right. We were all doing Borat
behind
season
the scenes,
one.
Favorite of all of us, where James would just sort of go into Borat.
Yep. All the time.
I feel like
we still do. Like, it's such a default when we all get together. Do you know who I think that all originated from? Because he was our friend, and then he ended up doing an episode later, was Michael Weston.
It feels like a Weston thing.
Yeah, it is a Michael Weston thing. Also, Tim, you had to get COVID tested last week
because
you were doing...
I was doing the television program This Is Us, and yeah. I actually had to text Dan Fogelman to say, buddy... I mentioned that I was on the show. Am I going to get fired or should we cut it out? And he's like, no, go for it. I love it.
Okay, great. That's good. Well, without giving away any spoilers, how did it go?
It was a lovely day.
I know you've had a really good time with all of them. And
it's such a great support.
They love
group.
You. It's awesome.
And every time I would get to work on the show, that was the really, other than, I think, last year come home, it was really the first time I was back on a set since my injury. So each time it's gotten a little bit better. And this time, I mean, the first time you saw me on This, I'm obviously playing a stroke survivor, and it was all about him trying to walk.
It was really beautiful. You're so good on there. I remember all of us pre-COVID times coming over to your house to watch that episode with you. It was such a special night. And I remember us texting right before you did, you know, your first day, because you were saying that it was like the first time you were... going on to a set that wasn't us, like our
yeah,
psych
it wasn't my
group or
beloved
whatever.
Psych family who knew it was going to take care of me no matter what happened. So it was a little scary, but they're a really lovely group of people. And so when I worked the other day, it was the first time I'd really done it without having to use my stick. I mean, I wasn't walking a lot, but it felt like a big sort of jump for the character. But like, I don't have to have the stick, this cane hanging onto it the whole time.
And that's all about you, Tim.
No, thanks.
You're a warrior and incredible. And I love that they're writing all of that for you. We're so, so thrilled to have Henze on because while we didn't see him, you know, as much on, what am I saying? Like an actor on screen, he's the guy behind the scenes, like taking
care.
He really
was such the man behind the curtain.
Man behind the curtain, exactly. All right, Tim, love you.
Maggie, love you too. And when y'all are watching, rewatching the episode, there's a scene where when you come in, say they're ready, the press waiting for you outside for the press conference.
Yeah.
And I improvised to James, "How's the knot on my tie?" And he goes, "Tight." Which actually, in looking back, the knot was not tight. Which is because, and I was very, I was always took great pride in my tie knots. Because I'm weird like that. But
yeah, you're
the reason
expert.
That particular day it wasn't tight is because our incredible sound department, Johnny and Carmen, Johnny Lava and Carmen.
Johnny Lava.
The Lavenders, who I know listen to the show, started hiding my microphone in my knots.
Oh my gosh.
And Carmen would always come in and start messing with my knot to make room for, to loosen it, to make room for a mic.
Oh my.
So I then swear at her in a loving way. So that's why the knot is not super tight when y'all see it. But that was one of my first improvs where I was like, I'm going to say, I'm going to, because it was always sort of James. I was like, I'm going to make a joke.
You made it funny.
I made it funny. And it made,
you made
it
a funny.
The show.
You improvved a funny. It was great. I love that scene. I'm so proud of you. And I'm so proud of that moment. When you, when I'm like, the press are ready for you. It's very,
you were
it's,
so,
it's very you're sweet. Adorable it's our episode. Sweet, sweet side. Tim, how excited are we today to have Chris Henze here finally?
Don't answer that.
This is going to sound really fun. Well, first off, Chris, if you have been listening, I hope you have been feeling all of the love that has been thrown your way in your belief of Steve and the idea and putting everything together. And from the very, very, very beginning, like it's you were so instrumental and you remain this way. I mean, you've been on every... I mean, the last movies, you've been on with us every day, pretty much on set. You have been to all of our Comic Cons with us. You are such a part of our everyday psych family. And from the beginning, stuff I never even knew. It's been really, really. It warms my heart to hear all of the stories from how psych came together, and then also your involvement. I just have to say. I was thinking back on watching Earth to Starbucks. My very first impression when I met you
was,
this is going to be really good. It's actually really good. And I think you'll appreciate it and no one's going to be surprised. But like, he's such a good dresser.
How did we all end up in this wardrobe in season one?
Have you been listening?
Yeah. But listen, it's the first thing that strikes me every time I watch those old episodes. I was like, what is happening? Like, how did I allow that to happen?
Chris, I remember being in a wardrobe fitting with you early on in the pilot and you mentioning my sloped shoulders and how we needed to put some shoulder pads in to because you used to work in, you worked in fashion retail, didn't you, at one time?
In college, I worked at Nordstrom. In the sun during the summers because I grew up in San Diego and so there was like five different Nordstroms there and I would work at a different one every summer. You could always come back and you always make commission, so it was always better than an hourly job, and it was such a great company to work for. So yeah, I did that, and then I'm sure we'll get into this because I'm sure this is going to be part of your question about me and Steve and the genesis of all this. But
of course,
in college or after college when I moved to LA. I got a job at the Polo store, Ralph Lauren store on Rodeo Drive, in order to kind of just get to LA and have a job. And it was like November or something. And it was, Christmas season. And I was like, I can make commission there and I can make some money and I'll send out resumes and I'll get a job in the entertainment business. And so I moved up here, by myself with, you know, a couple $100 and stayed at a friend of the family's parents' house in what I thought was LA. It turns out it was like Moore Park or something. It took me an hour and a half to get to work every day. And then I would go to the Polo store and very good discounts there because it's very expensive, but they did get very good discounts.
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, this is very impressive how you got here, but also I'm not surprised at all.
You didn't know that story? And then one day I was there for like 3 or 4 weeks and I was like, well, I'm not going to get stuck working retail forever. Like I sent out a bunch of resume. I mean, you know, I was a kid and I was stupid and I was like sending my resume, you know, I've graduated, you know, with honors from UC Irvine and, you know, and I would send it to like the human resources department at Universal Studios. Like it was just, I'm sure just going into like file and nobody was calling. And so I was going to maybe move back to Orange County, where I went to school, where Steve still was, or I was going to move back to San Diego and save up money and figure out how. And like that week that I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, I started helping a guy buy clothes and his wife. And he was an older man. He was very sweet. And his wife was very sweet. And he came in to buy a sport coat and he ended up buying, I sold him 5 suits or something. And he was there for a couple of hours. And, you know, he asked me, like, how long have you worked here? And I kind of told him I just graduated school and was getting into the entertainment business, blah, 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 blah. And that was it. And then I got a call from him at the store the next day. And it was like, Chris, the phone's for you. And I picked up. It was Chris. And his secretary was like, 1 minute for Mr. Zifkin. And as it turns out, he was the CFO of William Morris Agency. And he said, you know, I wanted to call because my wife and I were talking on the way home. And you're a great salesman. And I came in to buy a coat. And I ended up spending $5,000. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever thought of being an agent. But, you know, I'm the CFO of William Morris. And if you wanted to come in and use my name as a reference. So I said, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't want to be an agent. From what I knew of agents, it was, you know, it was all stereotypical stuff from the movies. And I was like, well, that's not what I want to do. I want to be creative. But I was not stupid enough to say no. So I went and sat down with the human resources person who, you know, I was in a waiting room and they called my name and she didn't even look up. And then she opened up the file and she goes, oh, you're a friend of Mr. Zifkin's. And I was like, oh yeah, Walt. Yeah.
Friend of Mr. Zifkin's. Wow.
She's like, so what do you want to do here? And I was like, I don't know. and I ended up taking a job as an assistant and saying no to the training program because I didn't want to go in. At the time, you had to go into the mail room and do all this stuff that I didn't really want to do because I didn't want to be an agent. I thought I wanted to be a producer. I didn't quite know what that meant yet, but that seemed like the perfect melding of business and creative. And so I, she said, you can start as an assistant, but you can never be an agent that way because you're not in the training program. And I go, well, I don't want to be an agent, but I want to learn about the business. So I was there for a couple of years in a couple of different departments in lit, working with writers and directors. And I mean, when I say working with, I mean, I was a secretary. That's what you do. You know, the guy behind me was a lawyer. The guy behind him just graduated from Harvard. The girl behind him was like a, you know, JD MBA or something. It was crazy.
But they didn't dress like you.
Nobody does. so that, you know, that's the long answer to why I cared about having cool sneakers. I don't know.
Well, so you and Steve met in college, though.
So Steve and I met in college in a intro to videography class or something of the sort. It was, he was an English major. I was an economics and sociology major. And for various reasons, because we both really liked the idea of entertainment in some capacity, I thought I wanted to go into the advertising business. And as it turns out, I just was a huge fan of Tom Hanks and Nothing in Common and loved that movie. And the idea of being Tom Hanks in that movie, who was an ad guy, seemed amazing to me. And then I had an internship in the ad business while I was in college. And then I kind of realized, oh no, I think it was the movie that was appealing to me and the way that that creative force was displayed in the movie, which isn't quite like real life. And like, maybe it's the movie business that I'm interested in. And that kind of started me on a quest to take some classes because this was UC Irvine, which had, which still has an amazing fine arts program. But mostly theater and dance and, you know, and not so much filmmaking, although they had a bunch of core filmmaking classes or videography and things like that. And they had a studio that was, all the equipment was donated to them by Sony, I think, like in, you know, 1970 or something. And so they had this big studio, bunch of equipment. And most of the people that were taking those classes were taking it for their GE requirements because they were dance majors, you know, or something. So
right.
Steve and I ended up in that class, and we both thought we were funny. And we both wanted to explore making short films and making movies. And everybody else was kind of there to, you know, do these very self-important little video things or just kind of check the breadth requirement off their list. So we became fast friends and started doing projects together and making little short films together. And it was the first time in my life where I didn't need an alarm clock in the morning. I would just get up excited to go to the lab and continue making his short or my short or whatever it was. And we laughed a lot and had a great time doing it. And we would find ourselves not being very popular with the other students because we would typically make fun of their short films with our short films. And then at some point, as Steve often says, the nice older man who ran the lab was sick of having us there and shutting down every night. So he just gave us the keys and he said, "You guys just lock it up, you know, when you leave." And we would just stay in the editing lab and this the little soundstage there, and we would make short films. That's it. And then a couple of them, we entered into some, you know, silly little local competitions and won a couple of comedy awards. And Steve went off to Loyola and I went off to Hollywood.
Wow.
And then we came back around a couple of years later, and Steve had written a script as part of, I think, his curriculum at Loyola. And he said, I had to write a script, take a look. And I read it, and it was Big Daddy, the Adam Sandler movie, literally, but it was called Guy Gets Kid. And it was really, it was really funny and fun and smart and emotional and hilarious, as you can imagine, in Steve's voice. And at that point I had just left William Morris, and I said, "I know enough about what's going on out there in the business to find an agent for you, and we should take this out and we should try to sell it." And we did.
So you were still at William Morris.
I just left William Morris after 3 years. I'd been in lit and talent, and knew that I liked representation. I was good at it.
You have clearly had that kind of sales side, but also you understand the creative, which is invaluable in representation, I feel like.
Thank you. I mean, for me, I don't even think I'm like an amazing sales guy. And there's people out there that are like, you know, they're fast and they're quick and they're smart and they'll sell you ice in Alaska. You know, I'm not that guy, but I was always the guy that people that my friends came to and said, "Oh, dude, I need to buy a suit. I've never bought a suit before. What do I do? Where do I go? Or I got to get a car. What car should I get? What should I?" And for whatever reason, I paid attention to all these things. I liked style. I liked, you know, clothes. I liked things. And I
so care. You're a life coach as well.
I guess that's what it was back in the day. But so, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I would be like, "Look, dude, let's go shopping. Let's figure this out. Let's get, you know." And so I was always that guy. And
you're like Ryan Gosling in Crazy Stupid Love when he's like, "Take Steve Carell," and he's like, "Let's go."
I did have a knack for it, and I grew up with three sisters, and I seemed to particularly be good with the actresses. I don't know why. And maybe I just, you know, again, like not having brothers, but having sisters was more patient than the average dude. I have no idea.
I know. It's funny. When I have glam or lighting questions, I call NC. But you get it. You do have a knack for it. Yeah.
The new year is a great time to focus on what is important to you. Whether it's saving money by ordering less takeout, learning to cook, or prioritizing your wellness, HelloFresh is here to help with endless options to make cooking at home simple and enjoyable. HelloFresh delivers pre-portioned ingredients to your door, including farm-fresh produce that arrives within a week, so you get convenience without skipping on the quality. Skip the trip to the grocery store, saving you the wait in long holiday lines and ensuring you don't waste money on excess food. HelloFresh cuts back on time spent in the kitchen so you can spend it on your other resolutions with meals ready in around 30 minutes or less. And that's actually true. A lot of times it'll say, oh, this recipe, like if you're reading a recipe book, like this recipe, you know, it's 30 minutes and it's never that. These actually are. Plus, they have quick and easy meals, including 20-minute recipes and low-prep, easy cleanup options provide an even faster route to putting food on the table. Don't forget dessert, you guys. Satisfy your sweet tooth with seasonal, limited-time goodies like Dunkaroos cookie dough or Vanilla Delight cheesecake. I know I've talked a lot about HelloFresh on this podcast. Tim loves it too. It really is this easy and it really is this good. It shows up. The food is so fresh. It is, and it's all spelled out, which is what I need in a recipe. I like spell it out for me, make it super easy. It's down to the minute what it says. So if it says 30 minutes, it really will just take 30 minutes. I can't say enough about it. The food is so good. Did I mention Tim loves it too? Go to HelloFresh.com/pineapple16 and use code pineapple16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. That's HelloFresh.com/pineapple16 and use code pineapple16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. That is such a good deal, you guys, and it is so worth it. Please try it.
But I did want to be an agent. I spent enough time at that agency at that time in the world where it was still, there were still weird personalities there and abuses. And it was just past the days of, like, you know, Hollywood bosses throwing chairs at people and stuff like that.
I was going to ask, did you ever have a phone thrown at your head?
But not quite. But a lot of like, you know, verbal abuse and a lot of banging on desks and, you know, I just kind of looked around at one point and I thought to myself, you know, I've put some time in here, but do I really want to do this? Because I don't really want to be like any of the people that I see in this building, in those offices. But I liked representation. And that's when it occurred to me that there was this small little faction of the business called management and production, where you could manage people's careers and you could have a business where you operated like a representative or as a representative, but you weren't a broker. You know, you didn't have 600 clients, which every agent did at William Morris at the time, and they were overwhelmed. You had a group of people that you really cared about, and then you weren't stuck in television literary department or motion picture literary or motion picture talent department. You could kind of represent who you wanted as long as you were passionate about it, and you could learn about different facets of the business and be involved in publicity and be involved in deal making and be involved in pitching and getting a job and strategizing a career and doing all those different things. And they were not bound by the Talent Agencies Act, and a lot of managers were able to put things together and package ideas or shows or series or movies or whatever, and then they would get a production credit or a producer credit. So there was a way to be a producer and manage. So that was appealing to me, and I was able to start a little company a couple years in, 3 years into my Hollywood career, and was running a little business. And
that company was called?
That company was called Atlas Entertainment. But there's a different Atlas Entertainment now, but... You know Cynthia, who I started that company with.
Yeah, I didn't realize that you were one of the founders of Atlas.
Yeah, that's right. So left there and did that for a few years and did exactly what that job was, and it was really fun. I was representing people and being their advocate including Steve at the time. And that's kind of when he gave me the script and we sold Big Daddy. And then we started talking about other movies and we started talking about TV shows and stuff like that. And then at the same time, I was, you know, I was representing writers because I started at Motion Picture Lit in at William Morris. And that was really fun for me in being able to care about the development process and then watch things get greenlit and turn into something that was actually getting made and be able to understand the process of casting it and making it was much more interesting than just selling, you know, 200 different widgets in one little finite division of the business. So that's kind of when it all started. And then I moved to a bigger company and then moved to and then started my own company. And God, that's been 18 years now or something like that.
Your own company being Throughline.
Yeah.
And then Kelly.
And then, yeah. And then when we, a few years after starting Throughline, we were able to get some financing and really wanted to make a go of starting a production company because my partners and I had all done what I was doing, which was we had produced a handful of things and just, you know, put things together. And if it made sense organically and we had found material or we had put the entities together and we were kind of shepherding the project, then we were producers on it. And we maintained our involvement and we helped keep things on track. And it felt organic to the process of representation.
So Throughline, for our audience members, who produces our show, is a production company and management company, right?
Correct. Correct. So we have, you know, sort of different, it's not really different divisions. It's not like, you know, one place down the hall. Everybody's kind of involved in doing various things. And we've tried to not have, there's 20 something people there now and, you know, close to 15 executives. We try not to have like, you know, the literary guys in department and the talent guys. Like we all are interested in representing, you know, people that do both and people that do one thing, but then also representing actors as well. It keeps us on our toes. It keeps us, like I said, involved in the development process and the sales process and watching something come together and then casting it. And it's more interesting. And you can stick with things. And then you have people like many of the people on Psych and our show that, you know, shouldn't just be defined by being an actor or an actress. But you do, you know, who knew Maggie was as good at what she's doing right now as she is, you know, and it's just, it's just a facet of, you know, being an interesting person, being talented at various things. And, you know, whether you're producing a play, writing something on the side, directing, or exploring any of those things, it's something that a lot of artists do in this business. And having the ability to work with somebody and that's a successful actor and says, you know, I don't want to just wait for the next thing. I read this book and I love it. And how do I get the rights to this book? And how do we help bring this book to the marketplace? And I get to stay involved and that's fun. It's like a puzzle to figure out. So it makes your career and your job interesting.
Now, do you still have the Circus Acts division at Throughline?
Yes.
They do everything.
Because I got some stuff I've been wanting to pitch you.
there's certain things I just won't understand, and I'll never be an expert at. The music business will be one of them. Circus Acts will be another.
Because you haven't seen my Cobra act yet. But when you see it, you will totally understand it.
So you start this company, Steve comes over. I mean, Steve, obviously you guys are best friends, but also, you know, he has Big Daddy. Big Daddy, we obviously know what happened with that. So you were with him through that entire process, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. So I sold Big Daddy with an agency and we sold it on spec. And it's what's really fun about my job is that we had this piece of material and we sat down and we're like, look here. And, you know, this doesn't happen quite as much anymore, but it's a little bit different now. But what, you know, you used to do is you sit down with a piece of material. And if you wanted to sell something on spec, which meant that it was already written, somebody wrote it in their house for no money. And they said, I've got this piece of material. And you're like, it's good enough to sell. We would take it out and you'd give it to different producers for their deals that they had at certain studios, right? So
you'd sit down and
you'd look at Sony, right? And then you'd look at all the producers that have deals at Sony. And some of them have produced, you know, Amityville Horror and this horror movie and whatever. And you're like, well, okay, they're not totally right for this. And some of them had produced, you know, Tommy Boy or whatever. And you're like, okay, here's a comedy producer at Sony. Here are the four comedy producers. Here's what I know about them. Here's what I know their reputation is like. Here's what I know about Steve. And here's what I know about the material. Here's what I know about the situation. And then you just try to use your instincts and your smarts to figure out who the right producer might be to actually have a chance at getting this made. And long story short, with that one, we ended up, you know, so you giving it to a bunch of producers to take into their studios. But at Sony, we gave it to a guy named Sid Gannis, who was a really, really wonderful, beloved guy who had been in marketing for years and years and years, and then became an independent producer, a studio producer. And he was involved for years with the Academy and putting on the Academy Awards and producing that. And he had a lot of philanthropic endeavors that he was. I knew a lot about him, and I knew he was a great guy. And I knew that his deal was relatively new and fresh. He had just moved from like the executive side to become a producer. So for us, we talked about how smart it would be to go to somebody who needs material, who wants to like jump off in this new adventure. And he's so beloved, and he's got this new big deal, and they haven't really spent a lot of money on him for him at the studio. So we're like, well, that makes the most sense. Great guy. He's going to treat us well. He means something to the studio. He doesn't have 50,000 projects he's trying to get made, so we won't be in competition. And so we gave it to Sid, and that was exactly the right move. And Sid was wonderful. And, you know, within 18 months, that movie was in production with Adam Sandler.
That is wild.
Yeah. And it hasn't happened since. I mean, it's like one of those things where it's, you know, like
that Dulé is so hard to do.
Like, I mean, Dulé is saying, you start off with the West Wing and you're like, okay, where's my next series for the next 10 years? You're like, okay, right. Well, we're going to go sell a bunch more and get those made. And you realize how hard it is and how you caught lightning in a bottle. And you know, it was enough lightning that Steve could quit his day job and we're off to the races.
Do you mean the one at Disneyland?
That one, yeah. No,
he was working Tiki Room?
At the time he was working part-time in Hollywood. He had, and then I don't think he had quite moved up here yet, but he eventually moved in with me and we were roommates. Maybe I was at William Morris when we were roommates. So, but yeah, he was working for a MOW producer, like just a couple days a week or something in her office, and just trying to kind of, you know, dip his toe into Hollywood and figure it all out.
I wonder why he didn't tell us that story.
and then we sold the script and he was like, okay, I think I'm going to quit the job and I'm going to put together a bunch of ideas. And we made a blind deal at the studio after the script and we pitched some more ideas. We had a blind deal for Steve at Sony as like part of his, you know, deal on Big Daddy. They were nice enough to say, we want your next idea. And so they, you know, guaranteed him a sum of money and said, now let's go find another idea with Sid, the producer. So I just said to Steve, like, come up with 10 ideas, one-liners, and we'll just, you know, we'll go through them and we'll decide which is what we're going to pitch to Sid. And we did, and we pitched a bunch of things, and I can't remember what we ended up picking, but one of the things that they weren't interested in developing was this idea that it's like guy gets into some legal trouble, and to get out of the trouble in the middle of the courtroom or the judge, he's like, well, I'm psychic. And he fakes being a psychic. And nobody can question that because it immediately splits the room in half and people go, oh, don't mess with psychics. And they're the real deal. And the other half are like, that's bullshit. So, you know, case dismissed. And that was kind of the one-liner. And so that stayed in the file folder at Steve's house for a while. And then it cut to a few years into me starting Throughline and now having more experience in the business and all that. We had gotten some financing and and went out and hired Kelly, who was leaving Fox. I think at the time she was an exec at Fox, and she was looking to be, and she'd worked for David Letterman, and she'd worked at the CW or the WB, whatever it was at the time. And so she had a lot of experience as a buyer mostly, and then also as a producer with Letterman. And I think she was looking for something where she could be more entrepreneurial and independent. And we found out she was, and sat down with her and heard great things, and hired her to come in and help us kind of put together, a real game plan and sell more things. And so I introduced her to Steve, and we set up a meeting, and we all sat down, and Steve pulled out his folder, and we started going through things. And that was, that was the idea that we all kind of went, we like that idea. Kelly's like, yeah, I do like that idea. And we're like, yeah, that could be something. And so we started working on it and expanding it and kind of turning it into a pitch, and then set up pitches and pitched it all over town. And USA, we knew, was looking for something, as they had been for a few years, that was appropriate to pair with Monk, which was their kind of one scripted hit. They had WWEF, and we ended up selling it there.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We talk about BetterHelp a lot on the show, and this month we are discussing some of the stigmas around mental health. For example, some people think you should wait until things are unbearable to go to therapy, but that isn't true. Therapy is a tool to utilize before things get worse, and it can help you avoid those lows. Honestly, I personally find therapy more helpful in the times when it's not crisis, even though obviously it's very helpful in a crisis, for exactly what I just said before about how you can prepare. You sort of get your, it's a tool to help you deal when those moments come up. I've actually been recommending BetterHelp to a lot of people, because I think it's so easy to use. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to, which I think is also really great. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy, and why I'm recommending it to so many people. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and the Psychologists Are In listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/pineapple. That's betterhelp.com/pineapple. You'll get 10% off. So good.
I've heard the podcast, right? So I've heard Steve explain it, and I've heard Dulé talk a little bit about it, and about USA giving us the freedom and the ability to let something breathe. And it's true. Very thankful for our executives way back in the day, 15 years ago, to give us the freedom to let something breathe. But the truth of the matter is that, and it's not to discredit them, they didn't have a full staff. Like you go to a network and they'd have like a dozen executives, right? And you go to USA and they had one show on the air that was a scripted hit show, and they were dabbling, trying to find other things. And they had like a couple of executives.
And I didn't know that.
And so we weren't bogged down with people trying to kind of like put their stamp on things and overdevelop and overnote and all that. And we had, one or two people who really liked this idea and were inexperienced at sort of all the bad parts of, development hell, when there's just too many cooks in the kitchen. And so to their credit, they all just kind of went, you wrote a great script, you gave us a good pitch, go make your show. Which, as we know, doesn't happen very often anymore. And so we went and, what happened to us today, if we were that age and that inexperienced, is that they would say, all right, you guys are great, we're going to pair you up with a producer And it's this guy who's producing something else for us, and we're going to throw it his way, and then he's going to produce this thing, and you guys can kind of be involved and whatever, and Steve will write it. We'll see how it goes. But they didn't do that. They just said, okay, how do you guys want to do this? What do you want the show to look like? I sat down with Mark Binky, who's still there.
Yeah.
And he was like, here's what the budget will look like. We want you guys to fly up to Vancouver because we think it's a better place to make this for, you know, you might want to think about changing the location to like Seattle or something because it's Vancouver. And we're like, no, but we're both Southern California boys. Like, this was supposed to be about a guy who could live anywhere he wants because he's kind of a freeloader and just goes job to job, and he's got the best life. He's going to live at the beach. So then we had to figure out how to make, you know, Vancouver look like Santa Barbara for a long time.
Okay. On that point, why didn't we have Sean live in the Wienermobile in a RV park in Malibu, like Rockford?
You know, we should have, because we certainly used Rockford Files as a template for a long time.
We also had an experience with the Wienermobile.
Well, that's true. I don't think at the time we probably could have, at least we didn't think we could have afforded the actual Wienermobile.
Right.
But yeah, that, you know, that would have been fun. We could have, there's so many things we could have done. There's so many ways we could have gone.
But we went the right way because we're still here.
It finds itself. And honestly, I know I'm talking so much. I could talk about this for hours because...
Oh, this is just the first time you're here. This is like...
Because I haven't even gotten to the process of, you know, casting this and finding you guys. And if it weren't in the middle of COVID, and had I not just had COVID for the last week, I would have gone to my office and pulled out my psych file, which I know I have in my office in Beverly Hills, in my little casting sheet. I don't think I have the one that says Tim Amundsen, but I know for sure, and at some point I'm going to frame it for you, I have the one that says Maggie Lawson. And underneath the little notes section in my little 27-year-old handwriting, it just says, love her.
Oh. That's so sweet. And that's going to make me cry. But you also, it's just like, we were all so, yeah, 27. Like, you know, it's just such a wild thing to think back on now. And like you just said, how things have changed. I don't know that shows, I mean, actually, I don't really even think shows then had, you know, as you said, there's always like, we're going to pair you with this producer or this person has a pod. So blah, blah, blah. Like this, for it to be your baby with Steve and everything to be like, okay, guys, make your show, as you just said, is really unheard of and dreamy. But I do think that is where, you know, given your vision and everything you all put into it, is where the magic, it was allowed to breathe. It was allowed to like find itself. Like there's magic in that, you know?
Well, and that the breathing part again is, I don't mean to de-emphasize, you know, the fact that there were executives that fought for us and believed in us, but you know, part of the breathing was the fact that we ended up on a cable channel that didn't have a ton of programming. So there wasn't a line of other pilots sitting behind us waiting for us to not do the right number and to just slot us in because we were too expensive. Let's try the next one. And that kind of ends up being the cycle with broadcast television because it's so expensive and your airtime is so valuable and your competitiveness is so important that you can't, it's not really the fault of the people that run the networks, that you can't give something 25 episodes to see if it works and let it breathe. Like you got to give it three and hope that your promo department and the creative of the show is enough to get people to show up.
I hear you on that. I want to ask you so much. And I also want to talk about Starbucks. Earth to Starbucks.
From the Earth to the Starbucks. One of the only titles that actually gives you the answer to the mystery in the title, I've decided.
You're right. We gave it away.
Poisoning the coffee.
Yeah.
We never actually see a Starbucks cup in this episode.
Yeah, we see a faux Starbucks cup with red instead of green.
Were we allowed to? Obviously, we were allowed to use Starbucks. That was a.
I think we could reference it as a title, but
got it.
We would not be able to use the logos.
So. Oh, that is so funny.
But yeah, I have so much to talk about in that episode. I mean, that episode was. There were so many firsts in that episode. I believe.
That's one of the things I wrote down. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe it was the first jackal, the beginning of the jackal.
We had not heard of the jackal. And it's so funny because, I mean, the jackal, that plays out. Well, Act Natural, I do believe, started in the episode before. But this is like the second episode where we use it again. I noticed the Act Natural. You're right, though. This had so many firsts.
The term nutshelling, I think, which we went on to use, you know, several times, was first used in this episode. That's some excellent nutshelling right there.
I felt like on a personal level, from Henry to Lassiter to me working with the boys and having this like my, you know, kind of an inside joke behind Lassiter's back or inside scoop behind Lassiter's back where we were sort of playing this thing with him. Dulé and, you know, his love of the solar system and the planets
Pluto.
And space.
It's the introduction to Pluto.
Like, and that was improvised.
I'm apologizing for the tail that you'll sometimes see
Never.
Fly through my frame.
Never apologize for the tail.
It's a dog's tail, everyone, just so you know. Or it could be a monkey's tail. We're not
Hi,
sure.
Hi, buddy.
That reminds me of your Lucy.
Lucy.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, the one thing that I was talking to Steve earlier today, and I, of course, just rewatched the show, that episode last night. And I was like, you know, there's something about, that just wouldn't be, we'd get too many notes. Like there'd be too much pressure to cut this down. But if you remember the way that that show starts, the way that episode starts with Tamara Mello, who's a lovely actress.
Who James,
Sean goes on a date with. And
Tumblers.
You're in season one, episode 10, you're 10 episodes in. But we, Steve, all of us, took maybe 10 minutes to fashion a complete scene with a guest actress who never shows up again after that scene. And the scene is him going on a blind date, thinking he's going to get lucky or whatever it is. And then it features a bunch of stuff. It features the fact that he does what he does and he's got this magic that nobody else has. So we're still reinforcing sort of what the premise and the magic of the show is and why this character is special. He notices the necklace on her. He notices the phone that she, the phone call she ignores. He notices all these things that people wouldn't notice and he starts to put something together. And then what he puts together is the fact that she misunderstands her relationship with her boyfriend and he helps her and he does the right thing. And he's a good guy and he saves a relationship from imploding. And he's like, here's what you need to do. Go call him, you know? And it's such a great moment it's a sneaky little moment to say, hey, we're early in the exploration of our lead character, but here's what you need to know about him.
Mm.
He notices all this stuff. He's not like you and me. And by the way, he's a good dude. Like, you know, and all of that was accomplished with humor and jokes and clever moments and everything else. And then the reason he's really there in the bar is to see Lassiter and to see that Lassie is there drunk. And that starts the whole episodic story. That starts the mystery. So I think today there'd be so much pressure to like, get to the story, get to the mystery. We don't care about this character. We're never going to see her again. Like, if he's there to meet Lassie, why do you even need that? Just have him come in and meet Lassie and get going and let lights cut for time.
Right. And then that Lassie thing becomes this foreshadowing of what the Carlton-Sean relationship could be
it's
seasons later.
It's the first, I think, it's one of the first moments where he then helps his, you know, nemesis at the department, where he's like, we got to help this guy. So again, he's a good character. He's a good person doing good things. But I was just so blown away because I'd forgotten all about it and had never really, probably never really registered until I went back and watched it, that it was such smart work. Not by me, but it was such smart work, particularly by Steve.
Yeah, you.
And the director and, you know, who directed
Zimberg. Michael Zimberg.
Zimberg. Mm-hmm. So it was just so smart to take the time to do that for our character before he goes into the Lasseter story. And then you know, does the same thing for Lasseter. But, you know, we were going to have a long time to explore that relationship. And then it's just so genius that then you get into the Lasseter story and it's compelling and you realize that he's drunk and you realize that he's got problems at home and you realize that he's struggling with a case and you get all this information and you start to get into the case and that scene goes on for like 5 minutes and you're ready to roll. And then all of a sudden you've forgotten about the girl and you hear, I'm engaged. And it brings you back and buttons the scene. And it was just like, it's so good. It's so good.
It's so good. And also I think you were just hitting it too about, and Sean being a good guy. If you think about it, this entire episode in a lot of ways is a selfless, you know, he's not really getting Sean. This is for Lasseter. He's out here solving this. He's leading me on a, you know, he's giving me clues to get to Tim, you know, or to get to Lassie. And so if you even pass the opening scene, almost the entire episode is about him. That's a really big deal. And I still love, I love that, like the childish, like his dad being on a date and he reverts to being like, like a 12-year-old, you know, mad kid who is confused and like he can't help himself because he's having all these feelings. It's like all of that in a matter of a few scenes. It's really
It's
a
by the
really
way,
good episode.
Maggie, yeah. who would have thought that in Psych the Movie 3 we would be calling back that moment where he's at the door of his dad's house going, do you have a woman in there?
Yes. Isn't that wild? It's funny too. You were just mentioning how like we almost had a this opening into him being a good guy, but also personal. Like we get to know Lasseter, like you said here in the beginning, and what's going on with him, and having some like compassion for what's going on in his world. And honestly, one of the things, just to mention this about Psych 3, the movie, that I loved about it was that in a lot of ways, while we know our characters and we know, you know, the personal lives of our characters now, having a personal way into the case rather than it just sort of opening with the case and that sort of driving the story, which I thought, I've called Psych 3 like grown up psych or like we're growing up, a little bit, as you've probably heard a lot on this podcast, but, we did that. I feel like we did that really well in Psych 3, but also watching back Earth to Starbucks, I kind of forgot. This was a really important episode. I feel like for this reason on the friendship level, on getting to know Lasseter and, you know, the beginning of getting into everyone's quirks, Dulé's love of space and James's ridiculous run.
It's the first time I see the butt kick run.
There's so many. I was saying that to Steve too. I was like, there's so many little things, because the moment you appreciate that the scenes were well crafted or something was well written or something was well performed by the actors that existed, you can also see those little moments. And it's most obvious with James, because he got to do it so much and he's got more screen time than most anybody else. But you all did this and you continued to do it more and more throughout the series as we gave you opportunities and freedoms and more episodes to play. But there's those moments that are clear to me, at least, because you're all like family and I know your faces so well, that I know, even if I don't remember, weren't on the page. Mm. And were those magical moments. When James picks up the glass fish and just takes it aside and goes, do you like this? It was a gift from a friend, glass blower, you know, and then sets it aside. That wasn't on the page. It was all James. And he's just constantly doing that stuff. And I mean, I don't know why he decided he was going to run like that, like, and kick his own butt when he runs, like, but it's just so funny. And you guys just all sort of found these quirks and things and moments. And the trick for us, as you like to talk about how much we hated the boys scream. Whining. the trick for us was always finding the balance, because we always wanted to make Fletch. Like, Steve and I grew up with Fletch. We were getting in trouble in our directing for the stage class at UC Irvine for doing scenes from Fletch, no joke, as opposed to everybody else who was doing, you know, these very important theater pieces.
Wow.
So we always wanted to make Fletch and get smart, you know. That was always the tone we were going for. And of course, we were at a network that the only thing they understood really in terms of tone and what they wanted to make sure we weren't going off the rails too much from was Monk, which was very funny and a great show, but not nearly as ridiculous as, you know, as we got pretty often. So it was always about, like, oh gosh, are they going to understand this? Are we gone too far? Are we being too silly?
I thought it was like, we were just having so much fun. I can't even imagine the dailies, like, that the network must have been getting, you guys must have been getting. And you and Steve, I can only imagine, had so many times to be like, oh my God, this is funny, but, like, is anyone gonna allow this? Like, the whining, you know, their screams and the whining and all of that. So it's right. Like, man, you guys let us do whatever we wanted, but also probably had to smooth over a lot of stuff on that end. And then I would also imagine, I mean, season one, it was just, you guys let us play. We just had so much fun, and we were having so much fun in the off time. And that I'm almost wondering if that was more like, just make sure they're not getting too carried away, even offset, just because that's what I thought when I was like, oh, they brought somebody up to babysit us because we're having too much fun.
You hit the nail on the head when talking about these sort of character points that developed, is because you said the word opportunity. You gave us the opportunity to kind of figure out what we were doing, what we wanted to do, and who we wanted these people to be.
After a long day, I just want to curl up on the couch and get lost in a gripping story with characters I can love and hate. Is that too much to ask? Nope. Thanks to Sundance Now, I always have something to watch that is binge-worthy and that I can be obsessed with. I love obsessing about my shows. Sundance Now is an ad-free streaming service created by AMC Networks for people who obsess over riveting storytelling and fresh perspectives. Sundance Now has original prestige dramas, international thrillers, and bone-chilling true crime shows. Every show is a sleek production with sexy lead characters. They've got shows like the hit British series, A Discovery of Witches. I love this one. It is the perfect mix of period drama, romance, and, like, edge of your seat thriller. Seasons 1 and 2 are streaming now, and season 3, which is the final season, is streaming January 8th. So it's already streaming. Guys, go binge seasons 1 and 2. The show is so very cool. It is a blend of everything I said before, and they're sort of wrapping up some of the big stories from 1 and 2. So everybody, check it out. You guys can stream Sundance Now on all your favorite devices for as low as $4.99 a month. Just download the app or watch online and discover exclusive shows from around the world instantly. I found my next TV obsession on Sundance Now, and you will too. Try Sundance Now free for 30 days by going to sundancenow.com and use promo code Pineapple. That's sundancenow.com, code Pineapple, for 30 days of free streaming. sundancenow.com, code Pineapple.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, listen, that's what's interesting about having the perspective of somebody who's also represented actors and continues to represent actors is that I've heard a million times, you know, from people that are clients of our companies and mine, like you get on a series and, you know, so much of the series is repetitive. And Dulé talked about this too, where it's like you want to hit the same beats over and over again because it takes a while for an audience to catch on, and they have to understand the surface level of all the characters, and they have to understand the theme of the show, and they need to understand all the obvious stuff to want to come back to it. And you go, oh, that's the bad guy, and that's the good guy, and that's the thing, and then you can start to play. And so, you know, so many conversations have been had where I'm like, talking to a frustrated actor or an actress about like, my character's not going anywhere and I'm not, you know, and it's natural because you're doing the same thing over and over again, maybe for a season, maybe, you know, whatever, more. And it's hard, but it's true. Having now lived through it from the other side, you have to say, be patient, because if the show doesn't work, you may never get those opportunities to explore and do those other things with your character. It just won't, because you have to understand the mechanics of the commerciality of this business is that they have to make the show work. They have to make people want to watch it. And the priority isn't to make sure that you're happy with the development of your character right now. Once the show works, hopefully we can implore them all and they'll want to anyway, explore sort of the other layers of those characters and let some stuff out from under the peel and let them get dark or let them get interesting or ridiculous or whatever it is. But like we wouldn't know most of the stuff about Lasseter or certainly Juliet or any of those characters had we not been given 130 episodes, 123 episodes to explore them.
Yeah. You know,
it's like, then we go, well, let's have Lasseter do this. Well, Tim sings and Tim dances. Let's do a tap dance episode and let's do a musical episode. And once we know all these things that you guys can play with, like, then we go, well, let's do that. And it extends all the way to directing. Like, it's like Kirsten direct an episode. Look at, she wants this. She's smart. She knows it. She's like being able to give those opportunities to people and have them expand their art form and not hate their job because they get to do other stuff. It's amazing. And I don't look at it as a gift that we've given to you or Kirsten or Jennifer Lynch or anybody that we supported. It was a gift that was given to us by our fans and a network that understood that something was working and they were making money and the fans were coming and it gave us more episodes, and giving us more episodes gave us opportunity to go, well, what can we do now? Well, you know, we've got a bunch of reliable people on this show that do more than one thing. Let's let them show off. That's, you know, that's a blessing that was given to us. We didn't really give it to you guys.
I don't know. I think you all gave us a lot. I'm sorry. I'm going
to you know, like Steve.
You steered the ship.
You talk about Steve's generosity. I mean, Steve didn't make the decision to be generous and let people sort of be the captain of their own episodes in the writer's room. It's just who he is, you know, first of all. And you can't change that. And it's his instinct is to say, you're funny for a reason, like go be funny and I'm supportive. Like that's just who he is. So, you know, everybody was blessed with that and everybody got opportunity because of it. But, you know, there's a lot of people that could have stopped the progress of that. There's a lot of people that could have said, this show's too goofy. It needs to be more like Monk, or it needs to be more like The Mentalist now, or whatever.
Right.
And they didn't. And when they made small suggestions that felt like they were taking the fun away, we had enough leverage in our success to say, man, we're going to leave that in. It works. Yeah. And we had a guy at the time that was running the network, Jeff Wachtel, who repeatedly said things like, I don't get it, but it's funny and it works. And everybody in my department loves it. I don't mean the show in general. I mean, you know, a specific episode or a specific thing. You know, I remember when James didn't want to have any score in his episode that he directed in the found footage episode.
Yeah.
And we're like, can't do that. That it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel like, I don't know, it's going to feel awkward. And James was like adamant about it. He's like, it's found footage. Like, we're not doing a score. And we were worried that the network was going to freak, or that it was deviating a little bit too far. And that, like, so we're trying to manage it. And James, to his credit, picked up the phone and just went around everybody and called Wachtel and said, here's the issue. Here's what I want. And Jeff Wachtel was like, okay, do it with no score.
I get chills when I hear these stories. It's
everybody, for whatever reason, allowing something to breathe, allowing us to take chances, allowing, you know, a couple of, you know, college buddies who had no experience to just, here's the money, here's the checkbook, here's a really good line producer, here's a really good, you know, executive on the production side. They're going to make sure that you guys don't go off a cliff. Tell them what you want to do and go do it. And, you know.
You know, we always talk about lightning in a bottle, and because I'm an actor, so it's all about me, I always think that phrase, we're always referring to the cast, which there is something to be said for, but it really, this lightning was lightning in a bottle with the entire group of people involved.
Yeah, including, you know, a big group of people in Canada that I think found their family, you know, found something to, I mean, because let's face it, like, look at the stuff that was going on in Canada. Like, if you were a crew member up there and you got to work on a show with, you know, James and Dulay and you guys and Kirsten and Corbin and people that are all generally kind individuals with not a lot of baggage that wanted to be there, like, it's just, that's lightning in a bottle. And it creates an environment. And to have the two guys at the top that were on set every day, and both good protective men who wanted to, I mean, they could have been women, I don't mean men, but they were men, not boys. No. And they were protective. Right. They were protective of everybody on that cast and crew. And they led by example, you know, and to be a crew member up there and get to laugh all day and then be in an environment where the cast is a family and wonderful and protective of each other and protective of you.
I did want to shout out Michael McMurray too, as I've noticed over the course of this first season, because I know there was like a hiatus and we came back and things do look a little sharper and a little, you know. But he, you know, in creating that sunny show, I mean, we were in a very rainy place, and, you know, and I, and we love Scott. We've had Scott now for, you know, the movies and years and years and years. But, you know, when we started off, this like joyous, sunny, talented, you know, guy helped. I when his name popped up, I was like, oh, right.
Yeah, Michael McMurray. He was our delightful director of photography, everyone.
Director of photography, yeah. And he was in charge. He, you know, director of photography, they do all of the lighting and sort of create that feel. And he really, that was a huge part of it, that warmth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And shooting on Super 16, our first season.
Wow, sorry. But yes.
Like, it's film that's this big. It's not, it's not like,
we really did have to check the gate.
We didn't, we didn't have HD camera. I remember the season where we had to make a big play to, you know, switch over to an HD cam because all the other shows were doing it and we were still shooting on, you know, small film. But yeah, and that's probably, by the way, where the, you know, yellow t-shirts and purple dress shirts came from.
Man,
is that this ability to this grabbing at anything that brightens up the gray sky and pretending like it's Southern California.
We have fan questions about this episode that I want to bring us over to here. Okay. First one is the question is, why did James run like that? Because he's James. I don't know.
Because he just can't.
Anyone have an answer?
Run like that.
I mean, I don't know the answer. We'd have to ask James, but my guess is that James doesn't know either. And in my history of professional relationship and friendship with James, and yours goes even deeper, I think it's safe to say that he was probably bored and wanted to find something to amuse either himself or one of you.
Exactly.
And said, I'm going to just do a take where I do this. And people and laughed on the crew and gave him, it gave him the strength to continue to do it. And then, you know, we kept it in because it made us laugh.
Yep. There were lots of those. you heard about Pluto line improvised. Do you know if that was written, Chris? It feels improvised.
Steve could probably answer that.
Okay.
And even if it was improvised, Steve will probably say, oh, no, I wrote that. I said that, what I just said, just to see if Steve listens to this entire podcast and calls me out on it later.
Good. Did you listen to his entire podcast?
Almost.
All right, we'll see if it gets here.
I just heard all the stories so many times before.
Of course.
You know, it's hard.
You guys know each other. if you discovered a planet, what would you name it? Whoa, this one's really hard.
Well, Uranus is taken, I guess.
Oh, I love it. We're all still 12.
Yeah.
Or six. I don't think we're going to top that. So I'm going to go to the next one. was Starbucks a sponsorship? I kind of asked that. Like, were they?
No, only mentioned in the title. Only mentioned in the title. It did get really interesting, though, in the later seasons when we would get like the tiniest of checks to completely rearrange our entire lives and episodes to get a Dunkin' Donuts shout out in, or, you know, a Toyota
something,
or whatever it was that became
strange. I remember that. I remember a Samsung situation, I think, at one point.
Well, and Laster drove a Ford Fusion, which we did
and,
whole.
And somehow, like, Dulé would be the guy that would always end up with, like, a free laptop computer. And we'd be like, wait, what?
He's very happen? Good at that. He's very good at that. Dulé knows how to work it. Where were the planetarium scenes filmed? Oh, yeah. That was in Kitts Beach, right? At that center?
Yeah, that's in Kitts. That was right around the corner. I used to take my kids there all the time because we lived right around the corner from there.
It's by UBC, and it's pretty close to that Molson factory where people will recognize that, the Molson factory from, or the abandoned Molson factory from Psych, the movie 3. But yeah, over there.
Right next to the Maritime Museum.
Steve reminded me that he wrote that episode because in the effort to stay out of the rain, he would find places while he was up there to write. And one of those places, he had an annual pass to the planetarium because our kids would come up and they were like little wee children at the time. And so he had annual passes to the Science Center and the planetarium and
aquarium
and the aquarium, which became an episode. And that's how these places became episodes because, you know, we just discovered the city.
How do we not have a Joey's episode?
Yeah. Well, good question.
That was filmed.
A good question.
We had many Joey's episodes, Maggie.
But yeah,
just like, another one film.
And you do enough episodes and we're like, what haven't we used? And Steve used to say that all the time. He'd say that to our location manager. He'd go, if you see any really great locations, no matter what it is, just bring it to my attention because maybe it'll inspire an episode.
And that location manager saw the crab sculpture / fountain and went, they've got to do something here. I got to take a picture of this and show these guys.
Steve was telling me that today. He goes, that thing was the bane of our existence, right? Because it would go on, it would go off, it would make noise, it would ruin the sound, it wouldn't. And so obviously there's an improv in that when Sean comes out and James says something like, they're like, what are you doing out here? And
he's
like,
I was just out checking it already.
I was just out checking the timers on the crab squirt or something.
Oh my God. That's so good. Okay. How much of Sean's presentation scene, how much of it was scripted? Probably most.
Oh, when he's in the talking about he's in the planetarium.
I've had that conversation with Steve recently, as recent as today, in fact. Because I asked him who came up with the infinitum. The infinitum octopusium or whatever it was. And I said, that sounds like Berman to me. And I was like, and the hammer of Jeff sounds like you, Steve. It's that sounds like you. And he goes, hammer of Jeff definitely was me. He was like, that was for Wachtel. And then I realized maybe it was a Bonnie Hammer Jeff Wachtel thing.
Oh.
He said that originally he had some like 5-minute, 5-page scripted thing in there. It just got more and more ridiculous. And we just used the funniest moments of it.
That makes sense. What was it like working with Richard Kind? He was so great.
He's sweet. He's a sweet guy.
So sweet.
He's what James would refer to as a journeyman.
He is a journeyman.
He was awesome and really sweet and funny and it's on Curb Your Enthusiasm this season and I think other seasons.
Yeah. What are your, we've actually talked about this before, Tim, but, what are your Starbucks orders?
I've got a hot order and a cold order.
We want both.
My hot order is, a flat white with one raw sugar.
A flat white, what's that?
It's basically a cappuccino with not too much foam. It's somewhere between a latte and a cappuccino.
Oh.
And it's just made in a certain way where it's got like a little spot of cream on top or the milk is on top. But what I usually get, because I started drinking iced teas so long ago instead of iced coffees, is a Fenty black iced tea, no water, which means don't water it down with more water.
No, so you want it straight.
A strong venti iced black tea.
I like it. And Tim?
For 15 years.
When we were working on the show, it was a red eye.
These days,
it's just a pike place.
I'm a grande soy matcha latte.
Are you still the soy, or do you just go non-fat? I can't remember which. It's been so long
since we had a copy together. I'm soy now, or almond. Oat.
But
I
did
like
you,
oat too.
Before, I mean, there was a time when Starbucks didn't know what soy and matcha, that didn't exist. I remember being in Tokyo once and going to a Starbucks there and they had a green drink and I was like, I was taking pictures of it and I was like sending it back home going, oh my God, this is so disgusting. They have like this green tea latte here in Japan because they drink so much green tea. And then it became a whole thing for us.
That's so funny. Years before, I'm going to sound the same. I only spent a little time. I was actually on a trip in China and I went over to Japan. I think I was there for like 4 days and I witnessed the whole matcha ceremony, which I just thought was, you know, I think Mr. Miyagi does it in, I had seen it before in a movie and I witnessed, it is such a beautiful art. And I was like, oh, this is the matcha, the green tea. And I remember drinking it. It's really bitter. And so years later, my little American self was very much like, oh, with milk? Great.
You're going to make it palatable for me and lots of sugar, please.
Yeah.
That's like Steve's. I'm telling tales out of school now. I know Steve's order. That's how close we are. His Starbucks order is the venti iced black tea with 3 Splendas.
Oh, Splendas!
Yes.
Chris, I feel like we're just like scratching the surface. We want you back. All the time. And by the way, let us know your like favorite episodes or your most memorable and we'll plug you in.
And your favorite thing about each of us for when you come back. Just make a little list.
Yeah, find that folder.
Yeah, there's a folder. There's definitely a folder for that.
There's a folder for that.
I'm just glad that you are in my life and have been in my life for a long time. And we're thankful. It doesn't always happen in this business the way it did for us. And everybody should feel it.
We love you too. And thank you for supporting us. And thank you for supporting the podcast as well. I know you have been a big supporter just from the beginning of it even being mentioned. So we really appreciate that.
It's awesome that you're doing it and you guys are doing it so well.
Love.
See you, Chris. Bye, bud.
Feel better. Thank you for all of this. Thank you so much.
What an amazing episode. We have to have Chris back for sure. He has so many amazing stories to tell. This is just the beginning. Thank you guys again for listening to episode 11 of The Psychologists Are In. Follow us on our Instagram at The Psychologists Are In and our Twitter at Psychologist Pod. All right, you guys, talk to you next week.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.